This is The Guardian.
Today, it's Black History Month, and we've brought together three star authors in conversation to discuss the past, the present, and the future of Black literature. Can you let me in on a secret? How do you write? Like, what is your process, and can you describe your setup to me?
How do I write? Mostly through faith. Like, I kind of get to my desk each day and ask, can I do this again?
This is Caleb Azuma Nelson. He's the author of Open Water, which is one of the most talked about debut novels of the year.
I recently moved into an artist studio, and it makes a massive difference being able to separate my living space and workspace. And so I know that I haven't a lot of time to write. And in that way, like, I just develop a routine and a rhythm.
That's really interesting, Caleb. I definitely don't write every day, and I get myself in a lot of trouble because I just write when I think I can.
And that's Candice Carty-Williams, author of Queenie, a debut that was shortlisted for so many prizes and won Book of the Year at the British Book Awards in 2020.
I write well under pressure, and I'm not yet willing to test out if I would write well if I sat down from 9 to 5. And I usually write quite uncomfortably in my bed. So am I a writer? I don't know.
I don't know that there's one way to write. So I'm delighted to hear of these very different ways.
And that's Ben Okri, the Booker-winning author of 11 novels whose career stretches over 5 decades.
I've written many different ways all through my life. I used to write at night at a desk as far away from everybody as possible. Then I wrote wherever I found myself, at cafes, write on buses. And now I write in the mornings.
Are you the kind of person who sort of takes notes while you're eavesdropping on people's conversations? Do you do that in cafes or buses?
I think that belongs to the amateur days of the craft, when you haven't developed your mind to be able to pick up things and retain them. So no, I don't do that.
That's me told.
Yes, it's Black History Month. And while it's obvious that Black history is everybody's history, 365 days of the year, we still wanted to mark the moment and celebrate Black creative excellence. And so today, we've brought together 3 very special writers to talk about the world of Black British literature. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, Ben Okri, Candice Carty-Williams, and Caleb Azuma Nelson in conversation. I want to go back to the beginning of you. Can you paint me a picture of what your life was like at home and what culture was as a child? Let's start with Caleb.
So I grew up in Southeast London, in Lewisham. And at home, it's me, my mum, my dad and my brother and sister, who are twins. But my mum is 1 of 10 and my dad is 1 of 12. And so we've always just had lots of people in and out of the house. And I think that was really like the basis of my desire to tell stories and also just be within a cultural setting, because those people who were coming in and out were always winding long tales. I think as a kid, I was really quiet. I would gravitate towards books whenever I could, but would also happily just go outside and play. But my mum always describes me as like a quiet, gentle child. Yeah, that was me.
And Ben, what about you? What was your childhood like? What were you like?
I grew up in Nigeria and came to London when I was a kid. My childhood is full of multiple places, a lot of moving. Even when in London and Peckham, we moved quite a bit and then went back to Nigeria. So I have very much an itinerant spirit in a way. The cultural presence in my life, very rich. My dad's a lawyer and a classicist. He belonged to the generation that had to study Latin and Greek. And he gave me this love of Latin and Greek. So I read through his incredible library, the great philosophers and all the classics going back and coming forward to African writers. So I read a lot because of him. There was music around the house. Conversation was rich. House was always full of people. You very rarely had your own space. So I'm very comfortable with lots of people, and I can write in noise for that reason. And I also grew up in the diversity of England and Africa in my consciousness. So I'm a kind of mingled person. Yeah.
Candice, what about you? You also grew up in South London. What were you like as a child?
So I grew up mainly with my grandparents. So in this sort of big, empty, quite scary house, I was always scared of ghosts. So I was quite a quiet and observant child. There wasn't a lot of culture around. And yeah, it was a bit of an interesting one. But I'll leave that there. And then when I went to school, I was still quite quiet and an observer. And I would always find myself in the library, but I wasn't a nerd. I was popular at school. I knew how to make people laugh. And I think I picked that up from childhood when I was like, how do you solve everyone's problems by making them laugh? I had a little sister. She was born when I was 9. And then I met all of my dad's children when I was 16. So there was kind of a new explosion of noise and chaos, but in a good way. Mm. But I can also write in a lot of chaos. I quite like that. A lot of chaos and a lot of loud.
Ben, you went to school in the 60s and 70s. And I guess I want to know if you remember being taught any Black literature or you remember what you had to read for English.
Well, when I was in school in London, the concept of Black literature didn't exist in the schools at all. We were taught Shakespeare and the Romantics, but nothing to do with Black literature at all. Absolutely nothing. Went back to Nigeria and we're just going through a transition and a whole generation of academics were fighting to make sure that Black and African writers were being taught in the syllabus. My generation was the first generation of changeover where they started to have Black and African works on the syllabus. So alongside Orwell and Shakespeare and people like that, you've got Chinua Achebe, Things Fall Apart.
Chinua Achebe was just 28 when he wrote the book, his first novel.
I wanted that moment of change in which one culture was in contact, in conflict, in conversation with another culture, and something was going to happen.
And for A-levels, we got Ngugi's Weep Not Child. It was just the first stages of a changeover from our old kind of education based on the English classics. Later on, I read my way through the Black canon as I saw it, which is to say I read everything and still continue to do that. But it's about time that that presence, the presence of Black and African literature and contributions in culture, be part of every curriculum in the world because it's an important part of our contemporary civilization.
How old were you when you first started that sort of re-education of self and who were you first exposed to?
Well, I was about 14, 15 when I sort of actually embarked on just reading my way through, first of all, through African literature. And then when I came to England the second time around 19, I read my way through Black British and African American. Baldwin.
Nobody, no man and no woman is precisely what they think they are. Love is where you find it. Hate is the way it will carry you. And it is a terrifying thing, love. It is the only human possibility, but it's terrifying. And a man can fall in love with a man, a woman can fall in love with a woman. There's nothing anybody can do about it.
Toni Morrison, Buche Mechita. That was really wonderful because I got to see my mother's story through her eyes in a way.
And we've been brainwashed into thinking England is more or less like the United Kingdom of God. And that when you come here, you have everything ready-made for you. All you have to do is just to stretch your hand, and there you are, rolling to wealth or into qualifications. And then you go back to your country, an elite.
There's two things here. There's what you're exposed to, what you're taught, and then there's what you choose. And I think the one that makes the greatest impact to you is your own choosing. I chose to read my way through this Black canon. I chose it deliberately and systematically. Bought the books and read all the ancillary texts and continue to do so. So I think it's also important to encourage people to make that conscious choice because sometimes, you know, when we're taught things at school, there's a slight rebellion in relation to them, you know?
Yeah. And same question really to Candice. Do you remember being taught any Black authors in school? And if not, who were your first choices in reading in the Black canon?
No, absolutely not. And that was really irritating because I was definitely in the library outside of school finding Black literature, doing what I could. But no, it was lots of Mice and Men, that vibe of American literature, which is obviously quite depressing. And then, yeah, I just remember Mallory Blackman being like the very first Black author that I was into when I was a kid.
Noughts and Crosses, the first one, was particularly inspired by the Stephen Lawrence case. I was watching a docudrama which showed just how the Lawrence family had been treated by the police, and I was so angry. And I'd been criticised up until then for not writing about racism, as if, as a Black author, that's the only thing I can write about.
But and then some of the authors that you've named, Ben, getting into those authors at university. and being amazed by this rich world that had opened up. So yeah, I did most of my actual learning and I guess Black world expanding when I was at uni.
And Caleb, is that something you recognise? And when did you first start thinking you wanted to become a writer?
So I think my engagement with Black literature, the same as Candy's, was like my first year at university when I found a James Baldwin book in a bookshop. And it was like, aside from Man Ree Blackman, I was just like, this is the first sort of like Black literature that has really galvanized and invigorated me. And I kind of spent my first few years of university like reading Toni Morrison.
It is more interesting, more complicated, more intellectually demanding, and more morally demanding to love somebody, to take care of somebody, to make one other person feel good.
And a lot of Baldwin just going through his work. And it was, yeah, it kind of gave me a lot of faith because up until that point, I hadn't really seen myself in the works that I'd been studying or that I'd been reading. I think I've always wanted to write, like I have always wanted to tell stories. But I think it was around that time, 17, 18, that I thought that this was something that I could do. I didn't know what the route was. I didn't know how it might be possible. I just knew that there was something pulling me towards the page.
And Ben, how about yourself? When did you first realise that you wanted to be a writer and make that your living?
Yes, when does one realise? Well, it was never a direct thing. In secondary school, I read a lot. Always loved literature, even in primary school. I was always the one sticking my hand up to answer questions about Romeo and Juliet or whatever. But I wanted to be a physicist. Then I wanted to compose. I don't know why I had these ideas. Then I wanted to become an artist.
Right.
But, you know, at school, I didn't tell jokes. I just told stories. And when people asked me stuff and whatever, I always told it to them through stories. It's something I got from my mother. And then the Civil War came. We suffered it and somehow survived it. And then I was in my teens, living in a rough part of Lagos. And people were being thrown out of their houses if they hadn't paid any rent. And sometimes it would be the rainy season and they would throw all their properties out. And I was so outraged by this. I wrote something for the local newspaper. To my astonishment, it was published. I was encouraged. I wrote some more. They weren't published. I was outraged. And I wrote a story based on some of the stuff that I saw. And before I knew it, I found myself writing. Journalism led to poetry. I wrote about 100 poems. They were all bad except five. I burnt them, kept the five. I wrote love poems to this girl who didn't quite fancy me, but you know.
The way of all tortured love poetry.
Absolutely. And so on and so forth. So poetry led to prose and prose led to dreams. And here I am today.
Candice, for you, I know that after university, you actually did start working in publishing and you helped set up this publishing prize, the Fourth Estate Forthright Prize for Black, Asian and minority ethnic writers. Did you know then or did you know all along that you wanted to be a writer?
So I never knew I wanted to write and I still question it now. But when I started working in publishing, I just recognised that the field was not level for every single writer. And I guess I've always operated on this idea of fairness. And so it just made sense to do something to redress the balance. And so it was really as simple as me having this idea to create this prize and asking my boss, like, oh, can I just do this thing, please? And luckily they were behind it. And then, you know, these amazing stories by these underrepresented authors in writing and publishing came through. And just seeing how people would talk about them and seeing how the same excuses were still being made about why these authors couldn't be published, I was like, maybe I will just write something. And so I kind of wrote to be fair again, because I was like, well, there'll be people out there like me who would like to read a story like the one that I probably would like to write. So it kind of came out of that.
Ben, you published your first novel in 1980 and became the youngest Booker winner in 1991 with A Famished Road.
I'm delighted to say, ladies and gentlemen, that the Booker Prize for 1991 goes to Ben Okri for The Famished Road.
What was the book's world like as a Black author back then?
It was very difficult indeed. It was just difficult getting publishers to be interested in the kind of stuff you were writing. It was perceived at the time that there wasn't an audience for the kind of writing you were doing. I think at the time, publishers made a fundamental error, and they still make that fundamental error. They assume that the impulse to read follows the impulse of race. They assume that if you are white, you will only want to read white writers. And if you're black, you'll only want to read black writers. It's a forgivable, but rather stupid assumption, because reading is a magical world. You know, you just open this book now and it's black marks on a white page. And if the words are well written, they take you to extraordinary places. If they're tough, they take you to tough places. The words do their work. And it's taken time. I think my book win in 1991 helped a lot. But then we also had wonderful publishers like Margaret Busby, who had been carrying the flag for Black and African writers, and she'd been operating more or less on her own. But it's taken time, and the publishing world responds, actually, more than anything, and I'm ashamed to say this on their behalf, they respond to success. If books sell well, they think, oh, there's a market there. They're very evidence-based, you know, whereas I'm humanity-based. I just believe in human beings. I believe that if you give anybody a good story, regardless of where it's from, they'll be enchanted by it. The trick, the difficulty, is to actually bring people of talent with people who want to read. So the future is good. Just we have to keep this fight going, and we have to write as beautifully as we can.
Candice, I feel I can hear you nodding. So I want to ask, how much do you recognise what Ben has said, and how much, if at all, has the industry changed?
Yeah, I mean, completely, I agree with everything. And also just Margaret Busby is the most incredible, incredible person. And she's given so much of herself to just making things better for so many of us, very selflessly. And yeah, I mean, as Ben says, it's evidence-based. And I saw like a surge of novels coming out after Queenie by Black authors, because publishing were like, oh, okay, there's money in this. Because Queenie was rejected by loads of publishers who said that it wouldn't sell, that there wasn't a market for it, that there wouldn't be a readership. And so it's obviously very interesting to see how things changed after that. But yeah, I'm hopeful for the future, but I do think that more underrepresented people need to be in publishing houses, because publishing is full of people who operate on taste rather than operating on what would be good to publish. And it ends up being the same types of people who are working in the offices. And I guess it's all about gatekeepers, isn't it?
Caleb, you've had a sensational year as well with your debut. I mean, what's your experience of the publishing industry been like?
I think same as both Ben and Candice, like my novel is one of those that has been able to emerge because Candice did. And it has been really wonderful to kind of bring a book out that felt like a story that I really needed to tell, and felt like a story that was very honest and appealed to someone who could be like a younger me. But it is still really difficult when you look at the landscape and see that things aren't changing quickly enough. I'm definitely still really hopeful about the change that can come about, but it does require an interrogation of the current structures that are in place, because so much of publishing is taste, and it is very much like what is working. There doesn't feel like there's any sort of risk that is taking place. And often that risk isn't even really risk. It's stories that deserve to be out there. And so, yeah, I am hopeful, but I do think that a lot more work needs to be done.
Is being seen as a black writer, and I say this with air quotes, is being seen as a black writer ever frustrating?
Yes.
Go on, Candice.
I mean, I'm constantly asked about how to change things in the publishing industry. It's not my job. I find that really bizarre. I don't think that Ian McEwan is ever asked about how to make publishing less white. And so it's a very stark cultural disconnect there. If you're a black writer, you're expected to fix the industry, and if you're a white writer, you're just expected to do the work.
Ben, how do you feel about that? About being seen as a black writer?
Well, it has its frustrations, for sure. On a practical level, I remember a time, it still happens in some bookshops, a time when if you wanted to get a black writer, you went to the black writers section of the bookshop. I really hated that. I hated that ghettoization. But then some black writers say, well, how are they going to find you if you don't have a section dedicated to what you write? I'm ill at ease with all of that. I think you're a writer, and if people want to look for you, they should look under the alphabet of your surname or your first name. Look under O, next to Orwell, or C for Caleb. So that aspect, that quiet ghettoization, that idea that the black writer can only write about the black experience and that what they're writing about is only therefore of interest to black people, there's a subtle implication in all of that, which I really, really fundamentally dislike, and I think it's demeaning. And it flattens the possibility of our talent and of our reach.
Mainstream thinking has evolved to understand that, you know, we need a multitude of voices, experiences, backgrounds, ethnicities. perspectives in order to tell this representative, diverse range of stories. And in that, there's also this debate about who then gets to write and tell particular stories or characters. And some would understand this as progress. Others would argue that it hinders the creative mind. Caleb, where do you stand and what do you think of that?
From my perspective, I'm always trying to write honestly, and also I'm often trying to render the people and the characters that I'm writing about with as much care as possible. And I think that that involves like a certain responsibility. And I think to be even having that conversation is emblematic of the lack of care around the work that certain writers are trying to create. But for me, I'm just very conscious of what I am trying to do and who like I'm in community with. And I think a big thing with the writers that I am in community with is this idea of care and responsibility and trying to honour both like the work and also honour yourself and the people around you.
And Candice and Ben, what do you think of that whole debate?
I remember Kit DeVille once saying, tread where you want, but just tread carefully. And I think that's really important because that means that I could only write about Black people when I know that I would like to write about a world of people that I've encountered or met or have in my head. And so I think that should work both ways. But I think there's also been an arrogance around this wanting to write Black writers that I find uncomfortable. And this idea that, you know, I can do that and I should be able to do that. And it's like, yeah, okay. I find the entitlement around it quite hard when it doesn't need to be that way. I don't think it even needs to be as big a conversation as it has been before. Mm. But, you know, certain people, yeah, they do really feel like they deserve to write what they want without caring about the subject matter or the people at hand, you know?
Ben, do you have anything to add?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a very, very difficult area because you don't want to go around putting limits on people's creativity. If we start to do that, then we'll all be in corners. We won't be able to write about even the people in our community because we'll say, well, do we really know them enough? The minute we do that, we shrink literature, we'll kill it. On the other hand, this entitlement you talk about is intolerable. One of the things that riled Achebe very much was a way in which certain kinds of white writers could come to Africa, stay there for a couple of days, and then imagine a whole village, sometimes a whole community. And the classic example is his response to Conrad's Heart of Darkness, in which the Black character, the African character, speaks this very weird, distorted, ugly kind of pidgin, and it's the only thing that represents their humanity.
A story that puts me in the position of savage, jumping up and down, you know, by the riverside. When I began to read at that depth, which is not a depth for little children, it sort of dawned on you one morning that there is something behind this storytelling.
Conrad has been around the world, but, you know, had he had a single conversation with an African? Had he been to their homes? Had he got into their lives? You know, I mean, white writers who say they want to write about other characters, they've got the freedom to do that, but only if you know these people deeply enough. Humanity is not interchangeable. You can't, as it were, just take a Black person and then imagine and pour a soul into them if you don't know the specifics of that Black person, because there's no such thing as a Black person. There's an African, there's even there's a Nigerian. There's not even a Nigerian. There's someone from a specific village and a specific place with a particular history. So we have to know a great deal. To imagine, to dream up characters requires having great love and great understanding, great responsibility as well. It's a bigger thing than many of these writers claim. And actually, these writers who say this thing that you can write about anybody, if you look at their work, it's not that deep when it comes down to it. The people whose works are deep are people who respect the truth of other people's humanity. Someone like Shakespeare, even in Othello, which I've quarreled with, he struggled. You could feel the depth of his attempt to try and give us this soul that he didn't really, really know. But you could feel the depth of that poetic engagement with this person's life and this person's fate.
Coming up, what does Britishness mean for our writers? Authors generally reflect the world around them, and right now in Britain, it does feel like there's quite a lot to reflect on with Brexit, Windrush, the pandemic. And we've talked about being black writers, but what about Britishness? Have the last few years affected how you see yourself or the rest of the country? We'll start with Candice.
I would say I'm British because of my passport, but I probably haven't felt as disconnected to Britain as I have in these last few years. Brexit, everything that happened around Black Lives Matter. And so, yeah, I feel like I reside here, but I don't feel any connection to Britishness, I wouldn't say. I feel connected to, I guess, like a blackness that me and I guess my friends have cultivated. My friends are all from different places in Africa and the Caribbean. So I feel a connection to maybe like a drop of Britishness within that, but not Britishness in its entirety.
And Caleb, how about yourself?
I think same as Candice. Like, I feel more connected to the diasporic community that I occupy as opposed to feeling British. Like, my Britishness, it's forced. It's like came about through an act of violence, and that violence continues to perpetuate itself today and always has. And I think that my connection with my Britishness is more on a level of like interrogation and trying to pass that out, as opposed to it feeling like something that I welcome. But I think the contemporary issues that we're dealing with, Brexit, the Black Lives Matter movement, the treatment of Black people in general at the moment, has all just aided that interrogation.
Is there no sense for either of you about wanting to reclaim any sense of Britishness as your own and sort of lay a stake in the ground and say, well, no, I am here. This is also the place where I was born. My culture is a valid part of British culture.
There are very few parts of British culture that you can be proud of. So it doesn't interest me to be involved in that.
Ben, how about yourself? How do you feel about Britishness?
Well, I feel Britishness is undergoing a kind of eruption at the moment, don't you think? I mean, what an extraordinary set of sea changes, and there's a kind of a, almost like a collapse going on. I think Brexit revealed an unsuspected and very profound split in the consciousness of this nation, a split so deep that the future still is very nebulous. And as for what the pandemic revealed, especially in the way in which Black people suffered, Black nurses and Black care workers, the way in which they bore inordinately the brunt of the pandemic and have not been really properly appreciated or even properly embraced and compensated for this. So there's a lot of turbulence, a lot of imbalance, a lot of injustice. The recent laws to try and restrict protest itself is so strangely un-British. But then I say that, and then I think of Margaret Thatcher and the miners. I mean, the recent argument about race that came out through the government, the whole racism denial, which is one of the most astonishing things I've witnessed in political life in 40, 50 years.
In the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement, the government put together a commission to look into racial inequality in Britain. The report found no evidence of institutional racism, that inequalities are more likely to be caused by geography, poverty and culture than race, and that ethnic minorities are haunted by historic racism that doesn't exist anymore in modern Britain.
This denial of racial suffering, of racial exclusion, of racism as systemic, is both terrifying and doomed and fascinating.
Hopefully this next question, it's my final one, it's a bit of a distraction from that. Because it's Black History Month, I would ask if you could recommend a couple of books by Black British authors, what would they be?
I would recommend Blood Conditions by Kayo Chingoni, who is a fantastic, fantastic, fantastic poet. And I would recommend, I'm going to recommend Open Water by Caleb Nelson, because I really did love it. But also, I think it's always fantastic when Black writers get a chance to express a story that isn't about trauma and isn't about pain. And it did all of those things and more. It's so beautiful. So thank you, Caleb, also for that.
Thank you, Candice.
Kelly, if you could recommend two books, three books by Black British writers, what would they be?
Actually, I'm going to recommend Kayo's first collection, Kumukanda, because I can see a copy of it on my bookshelf in the studio and it's like battered and bruised and falling apart because I've read it so many times. It's just this really gorgeous exploration of being young and coming from somewhere else to the UK and just trying to understand the self. It's really beautiful. And maybe some more poetry, actually. Raymond Antrobus's collection, All the Names Given, which I read recently and have reread a few times, is really special. When I'm writing, I tend to read a lot of poetry. And so that feels what's like in my rotation at the moment. And also a book called Dark Neighborhood by Vanessa Onumezi, which just came out, which is this collection of short stories. They're really incredible and sit somewhere between prose and poetry. Yeah, those are my recommendations.
Brilliant. Ben, how about yourself? Books to recommend for our listeners?
Goodness, I wouldn't know where to start. There's so many. My head's so swarmed with so many names in there. They're kind of fighting one another. I would really say, read all the new writers and go back and read the older ones. Read the ones that are now becoming classics. Read Sam Selvan. Read Buchi Mechita. Read the poets. Read people like Cass Phillips, Linton.
Always a shout out for Linton Kwesi Johnson.
Always.
Yes.
What a great reading list. Guys, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. A real pleasure.
That was Ben Okri, Candice Carty-Williams, and Caleb Azuma-Nelson. My thanks to the three of them. We'll be sure to put all the authors mentioned today on the podcast webpage. Just head over to theguardian.com to get a look at that list. And check out Ben's new environmental fairy tale, Every Leaf a Hallelujah, as well as Candice's new book for young adults, which is called Empress and Anaya. And if you haven't yet read Caleb's debut Open Water, what are you waiting for? To find out more about the history of Black literature, you can also check out the British Library's new interactive timeline and printable poster. And on November the 8th, Guardian Live has an online event celebrating and exploring Black British literature. For more details about that, go to theguardian.com/Guardian Live. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef, who brought all of our guests together today. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.